Support for this public radio podcast comes from KeyBank Capital Markets, specializing in corporate and investment banking solutions for established and growing mid-sized companies. Visit key.com/KBCM. And by the Society for Human Resource Management, meeting the challenges of a changing world, online at shrm.org. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing a wide range of tax-exempt portfolios. Details at putnam.com. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Finally, some trickle-down economics. Not the Reagan-era kind, the Bernanke-era kind. The Fed's been cutting rates for half a year now, and just today, consumers started to see clear benefits. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by America's Family Physicians, offering patient-centered care so employees can better manage their health and employers better manage their costs. AAFP.org. And by Advanta. Advanta salutes small business, the brave ones, the risk takers, all those who chase a dream and make their own way.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Today is Thursday, the 8th of May. Good to have you with us. One of the big questions consumers have been asking since the Fed started cutting rates has been, hey, what about me? What about rates on my credit cards or car loans or, oh yeah, my mortgage? A simple version of the really complicated answer gets down into the details of the bond market pretty quickly. But a part of that answer, about mortgages especially, takes us to the government-backed mortgage giants Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Mortgage rates in some markets around the country came down today. In cities like Los Angeles, New York, and Washington, D.C., banks are offering certain jumbo loans for a little above 6%. That's a lot cheaper than they were this time last week. It's not that the banks are suddenly excited to lend again. Our New York Bureau Chief Joe Barshay explains Fannie and Freddie have a new strategy.
Mortgage brokers say rates for larger mortgages started dropping a couple days ago. This morning, a $729,000 home loan in the Washington, D.C. area, for example, fell to 6.18%.
Average conforming rates last week were hovering just a little bit over 6% as well. So that would be a very, very aggressive price for that.
That's Keith Gumbinger. He's a vice president at HSH Associates, which tracks mortgage rates around the country. Gumbinger says we can thank a new program that allows Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae to guarantee some loans bigger than $417,000. It's in effect in 71 expensive real estate markets. Patricia McClung is a vice president with Freddie Mac. She says she recently started telling big mortgage lenders she'll buy these loans as long as they meet minimum standards.
It's not just that they know that they can sell it to us that results in a lower rate. It's because they know what price we'll pay for them.
Fannie and Freddie are under pressure to bolster the mortgage market. But Gumbinger says they'll probably make substandard investment returns on these loans, and they'll be taking on a lot of risk.
If Fannie and Freddie wish to make this a more permanent portion of their menu of mortgage offerings, they need to demonstrate that it has been a success in the first place.
This experiment to expand Fannie and Freddie's loan business expires at the end of the year, unless Congress extends it. In New York, I'm Jill Barshay for Marketplace.
It has seemed lately that every day I have to tell you about the rising cost of something or other. Today, again, it's oil at a record. Rice hit its upside limits at the Chicago Board of Trade this afternoon. Electronics, though, computers in particular, have dodged the price bullet so far. They're getting more powerful and cheaper all at the same time. But Marketplace's Lisa Napoli reports that's about to end.
95% of the world's laptops are made by Taiwanese companies. Three companies in particular whose names you don't know. They make laptops on behalf of the brands you do, like Dell and HP and Toshiba. Over the last decade, production of the laptops has shifted from Taiwan to China. Same old story. It was cheaper to make them there. Computer industry analyst Jeffrey Wu of iSupply says that's changing now.
Because the increased gasoline prices, or say petroleum prices, and all the resin that goes into the product, the plastic casing.
Just about everything that's needed to make a laptop is getting more expensive. In particular, the key elements of rechargeable batteries, like cobalt and nickel. And Wu says there's another problem.
the rising labor costs in China because of the new labor laws being implemented and carried out.
In the past, computer makers resisted passing along higher costs to consumers because it put companies at a competitive disadvantage. Now they may have no choice. But Jason Oxman of the Consumer Electronics Association says that's not necessarily the end of the good laptop deal.
Having 10 models to choose from at Best Buy for under $600, that suggests pretty fair pricing for consumers.
Not to mention, we're hooked. Oxman says laptops already make up 51% of computer sales, and that figure is rising. In Los Angeles, I'm Lisa Napoli for Marketplace.
That rice price I mentioned is only one in a string of rising food staples. Today, the government of India decided it's had about enough. New Delhi suspended futures trading for some key commodities there, including soybean oil, chickpeas, and potatoes. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Sam Eaton reports.
There's a stark divide between places like the United States and India when food prices rise. India's inflation recently surged 7.6%, the highest in 3 years. And for the millions of low-wage earners, like this woman at a food market in New Delhi, that can mean the difference between eating and going without.
Everything is expensive for me. I'm a poor person, so nothing is cheap. Lentils, ghee, vegetables, wheat, everything is out of my reach.
Today, the Indian government responded to these concerns by essentially laying the blame on commodity markets. It imposed a 4-month ban on futures contracts for cooking oil and major food items. The idea is to cut out any speculators who may be driving up prices with bets on future supply shortages. But Harvard economist Ken Rogoff says the plan may backfire.
Having the futures markets helps lock in prices for farmers and helps smooth production. The last thing you want to do is try to close down the futures markets the way India does, but the government just feels desperate to find a scapegoat.
Last year, India imposed a similar trading ban on rice and wheat, but prices continued to soar. And a recent government study found no evidence that speculators are responsible for driving up prices. Indian commodity trader Bitupan Majumdar says that should be proof enough that futures markets aren't to blame.
If you ignore the markets, it won't help you out.
Instead, he says, you take away the one tool that gives policymakers an idea of what's to come. I'm Sam Eaton for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, I guess you'd call it aimless wandering. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Summer's just around the corner. That means boom times for ice cream companies, or at least they really hope so. The industry's worth almost $14 billion, but sales have fallen as consumers have been choosing dessert options that are better for them. 62-year-old Baskin-Robbins is the biggest ice cream chain in the world. There is nothing like a taste of one of those 31 flavors. But today, the company announced it's branching out into soft serve. We asked Ashley Milne-Tite to get the scoop.
The last time Baskin-Robbins made a move this big was when it introduced ice cream cakes in the 1970s. Those went down pretty well. Ken Kimmel is Baskin-Robbins' U.S. brand manager. He expects soft serve to be popular too with kids and adults alike.
As you look at soft serve consumption, it's grown dramatically over the last several years. And now 7 out of 10 occasions are soft serve ice cream treats.
He says those numbers alone made soft serve an obvious choice. Bob Golden of food industry consultancy Technomic says the company's a bit late to the party.
Most of their major competitors, like a Dairy Queen, certainly McDonald's, offer a soft serve option. So competitively, they're somewhat of a disadvantage.
Baskin-Robbins is still the third biggest U.S. ice cream maker, but Richard Martin of Nation's Restaurant News says brands like Maggie Moo's and Cold Stone Creamery are nibbling away at the company's market share.
Those chains have grown substantially, and I imagine had they not come along, there's some sales there that would have gone to Baskin-Robbins.
Soft serve might win back some of those customers. It also brings in more money than regular ice cream, says Bob Golden. He says there are fewer ingredients in a soft serve cone than its tightly packed counterpart.
There's a fair amount of air that gets pumped in with that product, so it's also an attractive margin product.
He says the change will require new machines in Baskin-Robbins stores, but they'll be worth the cost, especially if it's a long, hot summer. I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
Shares of Google have been through the ringer this spring. The stock is down 15% from its high last year. Today at the company's annual meeting, though, it was shareholders putting the company through its paces, mostly over Google's doings in China. Investors brought two motions to the floor, one to insist that Google use all legal means to resist censorship. The other calls on the board of directors to set up a human rights committee. Neither one of them is expected to pass because Google executives say the company has to be in China. Commentator and investment strategist Andy Rothman says just when we think we have a handle on China's economic landscape, it changes.
China's Communist Party has just kicked off a third wave of economic reform. It's a process that should benefit Chinese workers, improve the global environment, and lead to higher prices for American consumers. The first wave of economic restructuring in the 1980s saw the breakup of communes and the return of wage labor. Special economic zones were established on the coast where cheap labor fueled foreign-invested factories. Trade began to take off as China abandoned the Maoist principle of self-reliance and ended its global isolation. Soon, cheap goods would flood into the U.S. This pushed down prices and restrained manufacturing wages. The second wave, in the 1990s, was the transfer of economic power from state-owned companies to entrepreneurs. It was a process symbolized by China's decision to join the World Trade Organization. Over a six-year period, 46 million state sector workers, the equivalent to Germany's entire workforce, were laid off in China. The private sector grew fast enough to pick up the slack and now contributes a surprising 70% of China's GDP. The third wave, just getting underway, is an effort to push China's manufacturing platform up the value-added chain. Today, most of China's exports are just assembled from imported components, and Beijing is hoping that in the future, more of the profit-creating parts will actually be made in China. The government is raising the minimum wage and enforcing environmental regulations. It's also eliminating subsidies for the export of low-value, dirty products ranging from leather to toys and steel and chemicals. This doesn't mean China will quickly go high-tech, but Beijing is saying it no longer wants to be the world's sweatshop for junk. All of this is great for Chinese workers and the environment, but it also means that the global deflationary impact of cheap Chinese goods is coming to an end. Now, all of us will have to pay part of the cost of higher Chinese wages and limits on overtime. And as Beijing enforces pollution controls, we will all have to start paying part of that expense too.
Andy Rothman is with CLSA Asia Pacific Markets. That's an investment firm out in Shanghai. We are online. If you want to reach us, go to marketplace.org and click on the link that says contact. In a different era, today was known as VE Day. On May the 8th, 1945, World War II was over in Europe. By the late spring of that year, scores of cultural landmarks in Germany had been destroyed, including some former royal palaces. Some of them were rebuilt quickly. Others were lost, though, until now, as Brett Neely reports.
The Braunschweig Palace in central Germany is an imposing building dating back to the 18th century. It's got columns and statues of royalty on horseback. But walk inside.
Ich hätte gern eine grande Eiskaffee-Latte, bitte.
And instead of suits of armor or priceless tapestries, there's a Starbucks. Everything about the palace is fake. The original building was bombed out during the war. The ruins were demolished in 1960. Palace 2.0 is just a facade. It was finished last year and serves as a fancy entrance to a $300 million shopping center called the Palace Arcades. The locals like the mix of history and consumerism.
I think it's wonderful. It's not really a new building. It's new old.
At first I was against it, but now I really like sitting here.
The new palace has revitalized the center of Braunschweig, bringing new stores, new tram lines, and 9 million new visitors in the mall's first year, says manager Jan Tangerding.
Of course there are critics who say, look, that big block back there is a shopping center, but they're relatively few and getting quieter.
The Braunschweig Palace is part of a fake palace boom across Germany. A conference center planned for Hanover will look just like the Herrenhausen Palace that was wiped out in 1943. In Potsdam, the state parliament just voted to move into a $200 million replica of a Baroque palace. Frederick the Great stayed there sometimes. It was also destroyed in the war. Total cost, around $200 million. In Berlin, the government plans to rebuild the decimated former home of Prussia's royal family. That tab, $700 million.
palace building hasn't advanced much in the past couple of hundred years. Stonemasons, sculptors, 80% of the cost is labor. Only now the workers are paid union wages. Why spend this much money to rebuild palaces that few Germans can even remember?
It's linked to an anxiety about globalization. People want a place to identify with, and they want to create cities that look like they did a long time ago.
Peter Schabe works for the German Foundation for Historic Preservation. He says a lot of Germans are sick of modern architecture. These new old buildings remind Germans of their proud past, while conveniently skipping the 20th century. This back-to-the-past movement started in Dresden, which was flattened by Allied firebombing. After Germany reunified in 1990, the city's famed Dom Frauenkirche was resurrected from a pile of rubble. Today, nearly 8 million tourists a year flood the city. Cities without palaces to rebuild, such as Frankfurt, don't want to be left out. They're building brand new, historic districts. Gabidolf Bonekemper teaches at Berlin's Technical University. She says there are serious drawbacks to the palace boom. Money spent creating fake new buildings means less money going to preserve authentic historic buildings.
Germany is full of castles, Schlösser, that are sold for €1 because no one really would want to invest any cent into them because they are badly situated.
She says what saved those buildings during the war, isolated location, may condemn them now. In Braunschweig, Germany, I'm Brett Neely for Marketplace.
Coming up, big agriculture just gets bigger.
In the absence of, you know, any regulation or enforcement regulations, you can reduce competition to three or four players.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials climbed 0.4% today, 52 points to close at 12,866. The Nasdaq picked up 0.5%, 12 points, closed at 2,451. The S&P 500 tacked on 0.3%, 5 points, ended the day at 1397. Ford Motor Company revved up 3%. News Corp printed a 2.5% gain today. Big ad sales from the Super Bowl and American Idol gave a boost to the media giant's quarterly profits, although I will tell you I'm not going to miss Jason Castro at all. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 3.77%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where a 529 plan can help meet your college savings goals. Details at Putnam.com. And by Gather.com, where friends can stay in touch. People are talking at Gather.com. Want more from Marketplace? It's all on our website. You can stream, download, or subscribe to podcasts of all our shows. And we have text of most stories, plus special reports and the Marketplace Toolbox. Check it out at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Friday. The Commerce Department releases the March Trade Balance Report. Barney's New York and the Big Apple is retailing some designer threads at Target prices. Discounter Target, or Target, as some say, carries a rotating line of clothes developed by high-end designers for the rest of us. This time, the line debuts at Barney's. And the first woman to host Saturday Night Live celebrates her birthday. Candace Bergen will be 62. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. The check is in the mail, and this time it's almost true. The first actual tax rebate checks are going to start going out tomorrow. Direct depositors, you might remember, started getting their money a week ago. In all, it's $150 billion worth of economic stimulus just waiting to happen. Retailers are already salivating over a cut of your cash. Sears, Kroger's grocery stores, Home Depot, everybody is running ads to get you and your check into their stores. But buying stuff is not the only way to spend. We went looking for some of the more unusual things people are doing with their rebates. In Fresno, California, Cynthia Cooper heads up the local Coalition for Arts, Science, and History.
We're just asking that if they consider trading themselves, that maybe they become a member of an organization, or they sponsor something, or they buy membership for their family and friends, or they buy tickets to a performance or a fundraising or cultural event, that they, if they're going to go and do something that's a treat for them, that they think in this area.
For the Reverend Mike Kinman, the focus isn't local, it's global. He runs Episcopalians for Global Reconciliation in St. Louis, Missouri.
We're urging people to take the economic stimulus check they're getting from the government and pledge to give all or part of it to organizations working to alleviate global poverty. For people who say, oh, well, we need to consume because that's what's going to get the economy back on its feet, what we say to that is the economy long-term is not sustainable. It's not sustainable economically, it's not sustainable environmentally, and it's not sustainable morally.
City planner Danny Klingler lives in Austin, Texas, but he loves his native Ohio. Loves it so much, in fact, that he did his master's thesis on a historic German neighborhood in Cincinnati called Over the Rhine. He's decided to plunk down his whole $600 rebate on saving a building there, and he's opened a website where others can do the same thing.
I don't need the $600 for anything. I live, I'm not wealthy by any means, but I have money for food and shelter and medicine and healthcare, so I don't need this, and why not put it towards something that's going to benefit an entire city.
Robin McDermott's from the city, or maybe it's a town, of Waitsfield, Vermont. She's a big fan of the local food movement, and she's a Vermonter through and through. She's running a rebate campaign called Keep It in Vermont. 200 people have signed up so far.
They're pledging to spend it at farmers markets. They're putting in their own gardens to grow their own food. Or one of the things that I'm doing with my money is I'm going to be giving a portion of it to a little micro grant fund here in our community that will fund small startup businesses.
Now, have you thought about an advertising campaign to get the folks from New Hampshire and Maine to come over and spend their money?
You know, we'd like the people in New Hampshire and Maine to spend the money in New Hampshire and Maine.
Whether it's worthy causes or retailers, convincing people to part with their rebate checks is going to be an uphill fight. A Reuters survey last week showed 70% of us are going to pay down debt or put that check right in the bank.
In Haiti, deadly riots over food prices.
Costco is now limiting purchases of rice and
winter wheat in Kansas City's up 25 cents. Corn.
Today on Food Fight, our series looking at the global food crisis, the profitable side of those rising commodity prices. Sarah Gardner reports from the Marketplace Sustainability Desk that big agribusiness firms are breaking earnings records as everything from grains to soybeans skyrocket.
You won't see their names at the supermarket, but chances are these companies had a hand in that meal you'll cook tonight. Multinationals like Cargill. This behemoth buys grain, stores grain, sells grain, transports it, processes it. It even trades grain futures. And that's just its grain business. There is Archer Daniels Midland, another grain and oilseed giant, and one of the country's biggest ethanol producers. And Bunge. Hardly a household name, but a leading soybean processor operating in 30 countries.
Bunge, in their last quarter, increased their net earnings 1,964%.
Morningstar stock analyst Ann Gilpin. She says it's companies like these that are reaping the benefits of rising commodity prices.
In most cases, you're going to be a net seller of agricultural products like corn, like wheat, like soybean.
Take Cargill. It moves grain all over the world. Last quarter, it made over $1 billion, an 86% jump over a year ago. ADM's profits up 42%. Mosaic, a fertilizer giant partly owned by Cargill, earned almost 12 times what it did a year ago. And the folks that make seed corn?
We did have a very good second quarter.
Brett Begeman is an executive vice president at Monsanto. The company's quarterly net income more than doubled over last year's. Begeman says farmers from Iowa to Argentina are planting more corn.
And given the high commodity prices and the demand for increased yields, farmers were looking to our seeds to help do that.
Monsanto is among five agribiz giants that dominate the world seed market. Fertilizers, four companies control the vast majority of sales. Soybean crushing, ditto. Flour milling, just three. Even those estimates are hard to get. Many of these companies don't comment extensively on their businesses. Cargill, for example, is privately held and told Marketplace it doesn't elaborate on its activities. ADM and Bunge didn't respond to an interview request. Analysts say Wall Street profit pressures have fed the company's size and market power as they build economies of scale. Steve Supan at the Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy says weak antitrust laws haven't helped.
And in the absence of, you know, any regulation or enforcement regulations, you can reduce competition to three or four players.
Recently, the head of the London-based World Development Movement called Big Ag's profits immoral, given the global food crisis. But in the U.S., the industry has escaped a consumer backlash, so far at least. Stock analyst Dan Gilpin says it's the grain companies that may feel some heat.
A real risk is for them to be equated like the big oil companies. Consumers were complaining about paying so much at the fuel pump. Meanwhile, these oil companies are generating record profits.
Big Ag may soon find itself in the crosshairs over ethanol. Some U.S. politicians are calling for a retreat from biofuels. They link it to high food prices. ADM, among others, has collected billions in biofuel subsidies. And on a recent conference call with analysts, CEO Patricia Wirtz was on the defensive. She argued that rising energy prices are the real villain.
I actually find it sad that these misguided attacks on biofuels is directed at the one alternative we actually have today to transportation fuels. And it's actually increasing fuel supplies. Retreat from biofuels is just an empty gesture that won't fill anybody's stomach and won't fill any gas tanks.
This week, two dozen Republican senators, including presidential candidate John McCain, suggested that the government pull back on the biofuels mandate. That could help other agri-food giants that have been complaining about the rising cost of ingredients for everything from breakfast cereal to animal feed. The meat, dairy, and packaged food companies are not reporting record profits right now. Tyson, the world's biggest meat producer, lost $5 million last quarter. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
We should tell you that Cargill has been an underwriter of this program. Tomorrow on our series Food Fight, the new face of hunger here and abroad. You can hear more of our coverage of the global food crisis on our website. It's marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. And by Putnam Investments, managing a wide range of tax-exempt portfolios. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note, Dateline Chicago's Midway Airport. Don't you hate it when you get stuck behind somebody going through security who clearly has never heard of the ban on liquids or is wearing lace-up boots that take forever to get off? Passengers at Midway got some relief from that today. The TSA rolled out some new signage reminiscent of what you might see on the ski slopes. Green circles for inexperienced travelers who don't really know what they're doing. Blue squares for occasional flyers. Black diamonds for all you road warrior consultants out there who can whip off a belt and tush your shoes in the X-ray machine all at the same time in 5 seconds or less. Double black diamonds? I have no idea what that would be. That is Marketplace from American Public Media on this Thursday. Today, the Dow scooped up 52 points, 0.4%. The NASDAQ rose 12 points, 0.5%. The S&P 500 packed on 5 points. That's about 0.3%. Kevin Arnovitz, Patty Hirsch, Karen Lowe, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. Coming up next time on the program, families struggle just to keep food on the table.
It's just hard to keep the cupboards full without having to spend more and more money.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money.
Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.